Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and this is The Current. Susie McKinnon always knew that when it came to the way we remember experiences in our lives, she was different. But it's hard to say exactly how. And it was a visit to Toronto's Baycrest Health Sciences Center 8 years ago that finally helped her unlock the mystery. Researchers there studied her and two other patients with similar symptoms, and ultimately discovered what they believe is a new condition called severely deficient autobiographical memory syndrome. So for some insight in what it's like to live with this syndrome, Susie McKinnon and her husband of 35 years, Eric Green, joins me now. They're in Tacoma, Washington. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Susie, let's start with you. Can you help us understand severely deficient autobiographical memory syndrome? Explain to me how your memory works.
Well, I guess it seems to work like most people for facts and figures and things that you can learn in your life that you use on a day-to-day level. But what's missing, evidently, is the ability to relive or re-experience events that happened to me personally in my life, like my wedding or being a child or going to a carnival or anything like that.
So, in other words, you experience something and you're in the moment, but you can't recall it how long after?
They don't know for sure, but it seems like immediately after. I can use some kind of familiarity with the experience so that I can talk about it, but I can't really re-experience it, evidently, right after it happens.
Okay, well, I want to get some examples from you, and you have brought some photos in of your wedding day, and I've got them here on my iPad, so we can look at them together.
Okay.
First of all, Susie, what do you remember about the day of your wedding and the day the photos were taken?
Well, I kind of use the word remember differently than most people do, I've found out. But for me, what I know about my wedding day is that it was a November day, and it was relatively sunny that day, which was unusual for the Chicago area in November. And evidently, our friends had, without us knowing, planned to ambush us at the courthouse. And so they drove there before we got there, evidently, and hid inside because it was a little nippy outside, I guess. And we didn't see them at all while the ceremony was going on. And then they were out on the steps when we came out of the courthouse building. They knew we weren't the type of people that did any traditional stuff, and so they brought everything with them. They made us toast each other with champagne glasses. They brought a cake that we had to feed each other a piece of. They did a good job of serenading us also. I think they sang to us out on the steps of the courthouse. Yes.
Oh, that's really nice. Now, I've got some pictures, and actually we are posting them online, cbc.ca/thecurrent, so our listeners, as they listen, can actually take a look too. And so there's one here. Eric, you're looking really happy. She's got her arm in yours, and you're holding a white box. Tell me what you remember. What does that picture tell you?
We were just coming out the courthouse, and we had just seen all our friends out there, and they were just kind of cheering and throwing confetti, I think. And we had just done it, and I was saying, oh, my God, we just got married. And then, so it was, it was kind of a really shocking surprise, a pleasant one, though.
Well, you know, if pictures can be so evocative, and what I see are two really happy people and big smiles. Eric, you remember the joy, I'm guessing. Yeah?
Yes, I do.
And Susie, can you remember the joy?
Well, I can imagine the joy. I sure look happy there. No, I'm sure I was. I'm sure it was a great fun and a huge surprise.
You do look happy.
But I don't remember it.
You can't conjure up the joy in your memory is what you're telling me.
No. I mean, I'm familiar with the emotion of joy, but no, I can't put myself back there and re-experience it. No.
Okay. So we have another picture, and you guys are sitting on the floor. We know it's 35 years ago because we can tell by the fashion.
Yeah.
But you're sitting on the floor opening stuff up and, again, looking really pleased. What's happening in that picture, Eric?
That's actually a wedding reception. What happened was, after the wedding, We got married at City Hall, and we went to my mother's place. And my mother and my aunt have been after us to get married for like 2 or 3 years. And then we kind of surprised them and told them that we'd gotten married. And we took them to a Chinese restaurant that some connection with Susie's work, and they gave us a free Chinese dinner. And then we went on a one-day honeymoon, and then we had to go to bowling the next day. But this
oh,
was,
I didn't know that.
And then we did a reception at our house. And those were all our friends there, and we didn't expect, we sent out invitations and told them no gifts or anything else, but they had all these gifts. They said they got tired of eating on paper plates and drinking out of paper cups, and so we had all these wedding gifts.
Wow,
and,
that's so nice.
Everybody came.
Susie, do you remember that?
I'm just surprised that we went bowling right after. I don't remember that at all. I know that we had a whole apartment full of people, and the pictures that we have sure look like everyone was having a good time, and there were a lot of presents.
What was the best part of the day for you, Susie?
So I don't really remember the day, but it looks like it was a great time. And Rick keeps remembering it as one of our best parties, so I trust him.
Mm-hmm. So when did you realize that you remembered things differently, that the things that the rest of us process and keep, you did not keep?
Yeah, it was kind of a fluke, actually, and I'm surprised at how I did figure it out. I had a friend that was studying to be a physician's assistant at the time. And one of her, we didn't live in the same state, and she had called me to talk, and one of her assignments that she was working on was some kind of a memory test to help define people that were maybe going into dementia or Alzheimer's or whatever. And she asked me if I'd take her test for her, and I said, sure. And then evidently something about the answers that I was giving her or the way I was reacting to the questions she was asking made her think that something was off. And actually, I contacted her after all this and after I had gone through the research. And she told me that she remembered being concerned for me because I was saying things like, well, why are you asking them about that? Because no one really remembers that. You're just inviting them to tell a story. And she's going, well, no, most people do remember that. So it was kind of apparent to her. And because of the questions she was asking me, she said, you know, you might want to check up on that because I think there's something kind of weird going on there. And that's when I first realized and started asking people. And it became clearer and clearer to me that my experience of my past was not like other people's.
So you just didn't know. And how old would you have been at that point?
About 21, 22, something like that.
And did it worry you? I mean, what did you think when you had that conversation then?
Well, I knew that I was healthy. I knew that I was functioning well in the world. So I didn't worry about it in the sense that, oh, something's wrong with me and something's worse is going to happen. It was more like, wow, I'm really curious about this. I've something this important and I haven't even had a glimmer of it until now. But when you think of it, people don't really talk about how they remember things. That's not part of regular conversation in the world. So I guess it's maybe not so surprising that I hadn't thought about it really deeply until then.
Uh-huh. So, Eric, when did you notice there was something different?
I don't know whether I really noticed it. It just kind of came on that something was different. I know I asked her, did she remember this or whatever, and she would say something like, no, I don't. And I noticed that when Suze gets mad, it doesn't last. It's just there and it's gone.
And is that because you can't remember?
No grudges.
I guess he thinks it's why we've stayed together so long. So
you're forgiving. Well, but so Eric, what did that mean for you? Like, did she remember your first date? That kind of thing. Like when you first started seeing each other, were there gaps in her memory of what the two of you were doing together?
She didn't remember it, but I, you know, reminded her like when we went to the baseball game. I don't know whether she remembers that now, but that was one of the happiest moments of my life. We went to a ball game and came back. It was a real nice moment.
And that was like early on when you were dating?
Yeah, that was very early on.
But you didn't say, what, you don't remember me? That kind of thing. That you didn't have that kind of reaction to her?
No, no, I didn't. I thought it was real special. But
that's his nice way of saying weird. Yes, he just thought it was weird.
Okay. Now, so Susie, have you developed ways to compensate for that gap in memory?
Well, evidently they're thinking that I do more of what regular people do when they're trying to remember things. You rehearse things. I have stories of interesting things that happened to me in my life. And when they happen, I know they're special. So I kind of go over them again and again in my mind. And I can pull those out in regular conversation and talk to people about them. So I guess I do a lot of rehearsal.
She also pays attention to detail. She knows detail and what's happening. And
is that a way of embedding embedding the detail by paying attention to it? It somehow goes into your memory?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's the first step of learning it as a fact, is to really pay attention to what's going on. I didn't notice I'd do that.
Mm-hmm. So, Eric, how do you help her when she can't remember things?
Well, not really. I don't. she kind of adapts and takes care of herself. I can help her if she needs, you know, what were we doing a few years ago, and I kind of try to remember. But on a day-to-day basis, she pays a lot of attention to detail, and she can read people very, very well, and read body language very, very well. She knows when I'm upset or what I need. She kind of adapts that way.
So your mind is kind of doing some acrobatics, maybe, Susie?
I guess not that I'm even aware of, but I've always been like this, so this condition isn't new to me or strange to me. It's just that I've found ways to evidently cope with it because it's always been that way with me. So I
want to understand a little bit more about it then. Do you have a job?
Oh, yes.
What do you do?
We just moved out here about a year ago, and so I'm entering into something completely new. I'm working for the state and in training to be a retirement specialist.
Okay, but you remember your training, right? There's not a problem with that.
No, facts from day to day, I do fine with that. Most of my experience throughout the years has been in association management, and I've been director of operations and staff vice president for various associations like home builders and business incubators, and most recently in Ohio for the tourism industry.
So would you remember where you, like if you're driving down the street, you remember where everything is, you remember where you park your car, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that seems to be, at least for me, a very separate kind of knowledge, because I've got a very good spatial memory and navigation. I can still not visualize so much, but it's like I have a street map in my mind, and so I'm always aware of north, south, east, west, and cities that we've lived in many years ago. I could probably find my way around even now.
But if you drove down the street and met a friend for lunch a week later, would you remember that you had lunch and remember what they were wearing, that kind of thing?
I wouldn't remember, but I'd maybe know that we did. Maybe I jotted down the appointment in a calendar, or so I'd know that we had lunch. I wouldn't be able to think back about what the weather was like or what they were wearing, but I'd have that bit of knowledge in my head.
Will you remember the conversation you're having with me?
Probably not specifically, but I'll certainly know that I went to a radio station in Tacoma. And this is very unusual for me. I'll remember that it happened, but I won't remember specifics probably.
Do you see advantages to all of this, Susie?
Well, I've had to do a lot of thinking about that, actually. I've had a long time. It was about 8 or 9 years ago that I first really connected and made this public to the scientists. I think that it's a good thing that I can't hold a grudge, that I can't think back over and over again about things that were said or what people did or stuff like that. I'm really happy kind of being in the moment And I think maybe it leads to some good mental health along the way. I suppose there are some advantages to it, I would think.
Eric, what do you think?
I think it's definitely an advantage. I kind of strive to be like her with letting it go. And I have trouble doing that. I kind of strive to be more in the present.
Well, you did make contact with Dr. Brian Levine at the Baycrest Health Sciences Center. What was it like to have somebody actually get it and to find a medical way to explain what your memory was doing?
I don't think I can even put it into words how amazing that was to me and what a relief it was. I was really very scared, very hesitant to come forward with this. Before then, maybe 5 people, maybe 6, I had told about this, and most of them didn't get it because I couldn't really describe it to them. And people's first reactions are, well, sure, your memory's bad. I don't remember everything about when I was young either. And yes, I understand that's true, but this really is different, and it's very hard to wrap your head around it when that's not your experience. So it was wonderful, just wonderful. I was so curious, and I had been doing research on my own, but to suddenly have this whole community of people that understood what I was talking about and were affirming, you know, the theories, the hypotheses that I had, and it was wonderful to make contact with them, yeah.
And since that, others have come forward. How does it feel to know there are others with similar memory loss?
Again, it's amazing to me because this feels like such a singular, isolated, personal experience. It's wonderful to have other people coming forward and saying, oh, yeah, me too. And it's great for the research if they can contact Brian and take some tests and questionnaires and narrow down to see if we can find more people like this. It'll just help them find more answers. And if it lets other people feel more, quote, normal, that they're not alone in their experience, that's great. But I also know that there's some possible payoffs research-wise with Alzheimer's and dementia and other memory problems all down the road. The more that they can learn about how memory works and what goes wrong sometimes, the more power they'll have to do applications to help people.
Well, it's really interesting to talk to you both. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. Thanks for the interest in it.
Susie McKinnon has severely deficient autobiographical memory syndrome. She and her partner, Eric Green, joined us from Tacoma, Washington. Well, Dr. Brian Levine is a neuropsychologist. He's also the chief scientific researcher at Baycrest Health Sciences Center. He conducted the research on Susie McKinnon and 2 other people and then co-wrote a paper identifying severely deficient autobiographical memory syndrome. Brian Levine joins me in Toronto. Hello.
Hello.
So when Susie McKinnon first told you about her memory, how intriguing a mystery was it to you?
I do get contacted by people with various memory complaints or various issues, and so they don't always turn out to be scientifically interesting. And so the first thing I did was talk to her, get some more information, and then I became convinced that we had a real interesting scientific curiosity on our hands.
Okay, so maybe you can, from a medical point of view, tell us a little bit more about what this is.
Okay. I can tell you that there are many different forms of memory. So the memory isn't just one thing, and I think that's where people might get stuck in terms of understanding this. So Susie mentioned spatial memory, for example, which is a type of memory. And then there's factual memory, or remembering facts, or understanding, learning how to do something. And then there's this thing we call episodic memory, especially episodic autobiographical memory, and that's the part that seems to be missing, which is the remembering and re-experiencing from a first-person perspective the details of past events.
So, and is it that they forget things or they never create a memory in the first place?
Excellent question. We don't know. To study that, we'd have to look at the time course of things. And you did ask about that, and she said she seemed to think that she doesn't actually form the memory in the first place. But the actual, we would think after experiencing something, say 5 seconds later, she would be able to report it back in quite some detail. So it could be a very rapid forgetting where after a few minutes, for example, all that's left are kind of the bare bones fat. So one theory of what may be happening here is that the bits and pieces that we do remember and retain as episodes and we can mentally travel back to, that's what's missing.
Now, what did you find when you studied the brains of the people you were studying?
We did several different brain imaging studies, and we did a structural brain scan, just looking for any structural damage, stroke, shrinkage in parts of the brain. And we didn't see anything overtly, but when we did computerized measurements of part of the brain called the hippocampus in the medial temporal lobe, we did find in all three of the subjects that there was an asymmetry. The right hippocampus was smaller than expected, especially when compared to the left. So that pointed to a structural change. Now, we don't know if that's chicken or the egg, because it could be smaller from disuse, or it could be smaller because they were born that way.
Okay, so what impact does this syndrome have on the lives of the people that you've diagnosed?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. So the three cases that we studied, we were very careful to rule out any history of trauma or depression or certainly brain disease or dementia. So all three are healthy and are functioning. We can't detect any impact other than, you know, it being a nuisance or unable to recollect things. In terms of functioning, they're all functioning normally, and one of them has a PhD, and it's very high. They're all healthy, happy people.
What was the most surprising finding or conclusion for you from this study?
I think it is surprising that they are so high functioning, because we study patients with amnesia in my lab due to either dementia or some sort of strokes or other types of brain disease. And of course, that's a handicap. Whatever happened in terms of this syndrome, they're born that way. And so when you start out with that, the brain develops compensation. And so that may be important in terms of understanding how people can compensate for memory loss.
There's something you could learn from them that could help someone suffering from a degenerative brain disease.
It's possible.
Or a brain trauma.
It's possible, yeah.
You know, so many of us have an emotional attachment to our memories,
mm-hmm.
that it sounds like a big loss, but she doesn't see it that way.
She doesn't. I think others may feel more strongly, have more sense of missing something, but for Susie, that's not what happened.
And what do you think about all that? Like, where do you come down on the need for that emotional?
Well, I mean, my memory is not great, but it's not like Susie's. So I'm like probably many of your listeners who can't really imagine what it's like, and so that's fascinating to me that it suggests that here's this thing that we consider really the essence almost of our consciousness in many ways, and if part of that is lacking, and yet she's. You know, they're functioning well. And so that, for me as a scientist, is just a fascinating thing.
So what are the implications of this research and how we might look at memory down the road?
If this plays out and that we find more people with this syndrome, I think there are implications for understanding how memory works in the brain. We don't know if this is, as I mentioned, a rapid forgetting syndrome or if it's about emotional connectivity. There's a lot of evidence to suggest there's a visual deficit, so it's about forming images. And so by testing those different questions, those hypotheses, we hope to be able to learn more about how normal memory works, because it's one way of doing that is taking people who have the deficit and then seeing what they're lacking, what part of the mechanism is different in them, and that could help us understand more about how normal memory works. They may have some benefits in terms of aging, in the sense that because it's often with aging that sometimes we lose those details in recalling specific episodes, and they've already learned to function without that re-experiencing of details from the first person perspective.
So how do you plan on studying this further?
Well, we have a website. It's called deficientautobiographicalmemory.com, and there's information on there for people who are interested, and there's a survey. So we've already gotten 300 people to go on and take the survey. Half of them have said they have the syndrome, and now that's not a scientific study yet.
You can find people to work with then.
Yeah, and then we can bring people to the lab, do more brain imaging, test some of these hypotheses and experiments that we couldn't do with just three, you know, a sample of three.
Mm-hmm. So we can link to you on our website.
Yeah.
And It's fascinating.
And we hope other researchers will study it, because it can't just be us. It has to be a community of researchers. You know, I'm hopeful that this will get picked up and other people will start looking at this.
Fascinating. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Levine, neuropsychologist and chief scientific researcher at the Baycrest Health Sciences Center in Toronto. If you want more information about Dr. Levine's study, visit our website, and we will also put a link to where you can take a memory test for his research. That is all at cbc.ca/thecurrent. That's today's edition of The Current. Stay with Radio 1 for Q. Today's Shad speaks with Liz Garbus, the filmmaker behind a new documentary about singer Nina Simone. Earlier in the program, we were talking about one particular ingredient in Nutella, palm oil. Dr. Yoni Friedhoff of the University of Ottawa has taken aim at Nutella for a different ingredient. In an online video, he demonstrated how to make your own 2-tablespoon serving of Nutella at home. We are going to pick up with Dr. Yoni Friedhoff at the final ingredient for today's last word. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Thanks for listening to The Current.
So, per 2 tablespoons of Nutella, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and a half teaspoons of sugar. 5.5 teaspoons of sugar in 2 tablespoons of Nutella. Make no mistake, Nutella is spreadable candy.